Hey, it's the Jim Bohannon Show. Glad you're with us tonight on the Dial Global Radio Networks. We are at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. And online, you'll find us at jimbotalk.net. The United States had begun to flex its muscle on the world stage after the Spanish-American War a little over a century ago. World War I solidified our presence among the top powers of the world. And, of course, at the end of World War II, there we stood all by our lonesome as the major power. Pretty soon even the Soviet Union melted away, and it became pretty much us. Which, of course, comes with certain privileges and certain responsibilities as well. The free people of the world and those who would like to be have looked to the United States as a beacon to provide leadership in world affairs in the name of freedom and liberty, a role which we have fulfilled more often than not positively and with some notable exceptions. But are we still upholding that promise that began with the defeat of the Axis powers in 1945? Or have we begun to get tired of the role, or tired of not being universally loved? Our guest tonight is Douglas Feith, senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, online at hudson.org, who's written the most interesting article at National Review Online, titled Obama's Failure to Lead. And you're pretty unequivocal about this, Mr. Feith. Good to have you with us.
It's good to be with you.
Tell us the central thesis of where you see the failure to leadership.
Well, I think that President Obama came into office with some ideas about what America's proper role in the world is that are really quite different from those of any previous administration. And I think he was interested in changing America's role in the world in ways that are pretty radical. He, I think, believes that it is better if we abandon a number of ideas that had been consensus ideas for a long time about the importance of American leadership, the importance of American freedom of action, the importance of defining our national interests, our interests in the world in national terms as opposed to global multinational terms. And I think he is looking to implement policies along those lines that would in effect change America from being a leading power in the world to making America more like one of hundreds of countries in the UN.
The world's bystander, if you will, in many regards. Isn't that fair to say?
Well, I think he believes that the United States and the world would be better off if the United States was not as assertive, did not play the kind of leadership role, did not have the kind of military power that it has traditionally had.
It is a little hard to understand, frankly, how either the United States or, for that matter, the world would be better off. And let me state quite up front and frankly that that's the order of importance to me, is what's better for the United States and then what's better for the world. But the world matters. And I'm hard-pressed to see an argument here. I certainly recognize that there are burdens to bear and prices to pay, which, by the way, are words, I believe, that came from the inaugural address, or pretty close to it, of John Kennedy half a century ago. But I think they're worth paying, quite frankly. And the mere fact that the Soviet Union disappeared doesn't mean we've entered some era of universal love and brotherhood.
I think that what we're seeing with the Obama administration is something that we haven't experienced in American history before, and that is a president, certainly we haven't experienced since World War II, a president who comes from progressive academic circles and came to his office outside of the consensus on basic national security ideas that really prevailed among liberals and conservatives for decades, for the many decades after World War II. And, I mean, one way to think about it is there was a certain fairly substantial area of agreement, even though there were lots of vigorous debates about foreign and defense policy in recent decades. There was a certain consensus about a number of key ideas, that U.S. leadership was crucial, that if the United States did not take a strong position of leadership and assume the mantle of leader of the free world, then lots of things in the world that would be in the interest of the free world to do would not get done. That was a view of both liberals and conservatives. The idea that America's role in the world was largely positive. And it's not that we don't make mistakes, but basically our role as a leader and as an active player in world affairs was positive, was important, and the idea that America should define its interests in the world first and foremost as a national matter. What are the point that you were just making, Jim, that first comes consideration of what's in the national interest, and then one can also have considerations of broader global interests, but that it's perfectly okay, that it's not selfish to define our interests in the world nationally. That was something that both liberals and conservatives, by and large, agreed to. That American freedom of action was important. That if a president of the United States believed that something needed to be done in the national interest, the fact that another power on the UN Security Council, like China or Russia, might disapprove and veto that should not bar the American president from taking the action that he believed was necessary in the U.S. national interest. Again, liberals and conservatives supported that idea for decades. Now, while there was this consensus among liberals and conservatives, despite all their debates on various particular issues, there was a group of people that were concentrated in universities across the United States, progressives in universities, who looked at that whole consensus and rejected it and said, when the United States acts in its own national interest, that's narrow and selfish. When we are looking to preserve our own freedom of action, what we're doing is being unilateralist and ignoring and being disrespectful of the views of others around the world. When the United States is highly militarily capable, we get involved in errors and disasters. Vietnam or the Iraq War or other things that this group opposes, that's what happens when the United States has freedom of action. That's what happens when we have military capability and an inclination to use it. That's what happens when we're assertive and we take on the mantle of leadership.
Well, they seem to forget the fact that errors also occur when we do not get involved. Errors occurred, for example, when the world sat by and watched Hitler rearm the Rhineland in 1936 and then start his march across Europe with Austria and the Sudetenland and Czechoslovakia. Errors also occur when you just sit back and hope for the best.
No, I think that's correct, and I think that it is still the case that this view of that is so common among progressive academics is very unusual, very unpopular within the general population, and so President Obama is in an interesting bind, as it were. The views of the academic left, he expressed in his writings, and it's interesting that if you look at key people that he appointed in his administration, people like Samantha Power, who is a White House National Security Council official, and Anne Marie Slaughter from Samantha Power, by the way, was from Harvard. Anne Marie Slaughter from Princeton was the director of policy planning in the State Department for President Obama. people like Harold Coe, the legal advisor in the State Department now, who was the dean of Yale Law School. I mean, these very eminent academics, progressive academics, have long paper trails.
They do. And when we come back, I want to take a look at part of the paper trail in the article that you write for National Review Online. In fact, you quote a most interesting part of that paper trail from Samantha Power from an 03 article in the New Republic. And I'll give her credit for this. That's a lot more candid than most people of this view have been over the years. When we come back, we'll discuss that on the Jim Bohannon Show with our guest, Douglas Feith from the Hudson Institute. Hudson.org is their website. We're at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. We'll be right back. Thanks for being with us on the Jim Bohannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. Our guest is Douglas Feith, Senior Fellow at the Hudson Institute. He has written an article for National Review Online titled Obama's Failure to Lead, and he notes the people who the president has surrounded himself with, and of course, that's always a reasonable judge of people's actions, activities, and proclivities. And this article was from 03 in the New Republic, and Harvard lecturer Samantha Power referred to American pride in our freedoms of speech, religion, voting, and assembly. And then Mr. Feith, she said what?
Well, then she said that, and I'm quoting, much anti-Americanism derives from the role U.S. political, economic, and military power has played in denying such freedoms to others. And then in the article, she says that it would be good if we instituted a doctrine of the mea culpa. And then she drew a parallel between America's actions and those of the Nazis. And here's an amazing quote from this New Republic article that she wrote in 2003. She was referring to Willy Brandt, who was the German chancellor. And she said, quote, "When Willy Brandt went down on one knee in the Warsaw ghetto, his gesture was gratifying to World War II survivors, but it was also ennobling and cathartic for Germany. Would such an approach be futile for the United States?"
And so here she is making a direct comparison between the actions and policies of the United States and the actions and policies of Nazi Germany. Now, you could, in some cases, you could kiss this off as just somebody who doesn't have three digits in their IQ. Unfortunately, I don't think that probably is the case in Samantha Power's instance.
I mean, she was at the time a lecturer at Harvard. She's the author of several best-selling books that have been extremely favorably reviewed, and she's now an official in the White House on the National Security Council staff, and is considered an influential person in the Obama administration. What's so extraordinary is that this reflects a certain view of American history. I mean, she basically...
Well, obviously, that you can even make the equation of a deliberate policy to wipe out Jews in Europe, for example, a deliberate policy of activity that is so at odds with anything the United States has ever taken on to do.
I mean, conquest and theft and mass killing and genocide, and I mean, and for her to suggest that what the United States has done in the world over recent decades requires an apology along the lines, you know, from the American president, along the lines of the apology that the German chancellor issued in the Warsaw ghetto for the Holocaust, reflects an extraordinarily negative view of American history.
It does, and an extraordinarily inaccurate one. And I accept the fact that there are vacuum-headed gas bags out there, and that many of them have fancy degrees associated with them. But what bothers me is that people like that are put in positions of power. That's the problem.
Well, and I think it's also important to point out that what Samantha Power wrote here is not a wild outlying view among progressive academics. And it's also interesting, when she wrote this, she didn't write it in some fringe publication. She published it in the New Republic.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in 2003, so it was very early in the Bush administration, so it's quite clear that she was not suggesting that this was simply a reference to the Bush administration. This was clearly something that was a reference to American history over recent decades. And when the article came out, it caused no flap at all. In other words, it wasn't as if this was considered such an extraordinary, weird, wrong-headed, anti-American view that, you know, people started demanding her termination at Harvard. It caused no flap at all. And it's not that unusual a view in progressive academic circles. And a strongly negative view of American history over recent decades, a view that says that America, instead of being basically a force for good in the world, is really a selfish country, a bullying country, a militaristic country, a country that causes wars and wastes resources and is just a major problem in the world rather than a constructive force. That is a view that arguably predominates in progressive academic circles.
True. I would make no argument with that. You mentioned one other individual, Anne Marie Slaughter, in a recent Woodrow Wilson Center essay, who served as the State Department's Director of Policy Planning from 2009 to 2011, that is to say, in the Obama administration. And you also, in your article, include something that she said.
Yes. I mean, she also talks about the problems with American history. She says the United States should stop trying to dominate and direct global affairs. The best we can do is to build our capital so that we can influence events as they arise.
Oh, that's awfully, awfully antagonistic, militaristic, and interventionist to think that we should be influencing events. Shouldn't we just sit back and be passive? Wouldn't that be much better? Maybe genuflect occasionally to that quantity known as world opinion, as if there in fact was such a thing?
Well, this notion that America's role is dominating and directing and bullying people and pushing them around is the key concept here.
Yeah. So as we come up to the break here, when Douglas Feith writes of Obama's failure to lead, when we come back, we will take a look at the possibility that if we were to, in fact, be hearing a forthright response, it might be, and that's a good thing. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Jimbo Hannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-504-6626. As Douglas Feith, senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, talks of his article in National Review Online, Obama's Failure to Lead, an article which is rather critical and rather insightful, quoting directly people the president has chosen to work with and to surround himself with in the White House. I would suspect, again, to the extent that that they are willing to be candid and pure academics, not in elective office, are probably more candid than, say, a president who must try and cater to public thought. I'm not sure they would disagree with the thing that we've said, except for the fact that we're disparaging it. That, yes, that's what we're suggesting, and it's a great idea. We should just sit back and let the world go its way and be proudly just another member of the United Nations. Isn't that pretty much their view?
Well, that is, and I think it's interesting point that you're making, I have found that as I've discussed this issue with various people who are strong Obama supporters, a number of them have said to me that they said that they actually take a lot of comfort from this analysis, because they said, we supported Obama for president because we believed he had these views that predominate in progressive academic circles. They said, we've actually been disturbed that he has not governed as president completely in line with these views. And they said, but if you say that he really sincerely is attached to them and he will implement them as best he can, although as president he needs to make some compromises in order to be a political success and sometimes deviate from these progressive principles, then they say, we feel much better about him. If he really is attached to these principles and is merely maneuvering for political pragmatic reasons, then we feel better than we would if we thought that he actually had abandoned the principles.
Although it's interesting to note, of course, if you want to see criticism of the president, go to conservative blogs and websites. So the second best place to go is liberal websites and blogs, because a lot of people do not have that pragmatic point of view. And there are a lot of people who consider the president a sellout. He didn't immediately shut down Gitmo. He didn't immediately pull our troops out of Afghanistan and Iraq. He didn't immediately have every detainee tried in a civilian court. He didn't go to the mat for a single-payer national health care plan. A lot of people out there are unhappy with this president as a sellout.
That's
for their
right.
for their point of view.
That's right. And I think that I mean, my basic evaluation is I reject the common notion that leaders are either ideologues or pragmatists. Very often, successful political leaders are both. They are ideological and they're pragmatic. If they're ideological and not pragmatic at all, then they're not, by and large, successful political leaders. And I think that President Obama has a strong ideological view of American history and the proper role of the United States in world affairs. And I think it does influence his thinking about foreign and defense policy. And I think he is very much in line with this predominant view in progressive academic circles. And I think he has that that inclination to believe that if the United States pursues its own national interests and asserts its leadership, we are going to damage ourselves and the world. And that it is much better that we be constrained, that we be less militarily capable, that we be less assertive, play less of a leadership role, have less military capability and the like.
Now, he certainly knows all the buzzwords. He certainly knows all the buzzwords. You quote him in your article. You said, Mr. Obama explained to Time that he favors, quote, an American leadership that recognizes the rise of countries like China and India and Brazil. It's a U.S. leadership, again, leadership, that recognizes our limits in terms of resources, capacity. Knowing one's own limitations is good. It can help advance one's interests. But that's different from shackling oneself or deciding to act only with lots of company. If leadership means joining the crowd, that's an Orwellian inversion of vocabulary. Now, please go on and explain some of, because the president clearly is not going, at least in terms of public utterances, as far as some of the more off-the-wall advice that he is getting, and quite frankly, in action. I mean, all those things I cited a moment ago that caused all the panties to get in a bunch in liberal circles were things that I said, thank goodness he pulled back from the brink of stupidity. I'm still not exactly a supporter of his, but I think that he's gone from being a complete abject failure to at least on occasion recognizing some of the realities of the world. I would applaud him for that. Not enough to vote for him, but I would applaud him for that.
Well, I think that, I mean, we can all be happy that he does have his pragmatism, because I think he could have done enormous harm to the United States had he simply pursued his ideological inclinations. He is intent on being a successful political leader. And he knows that his ideology won't matter and won't affect the United States and the world much at all if he is a failure as a political leader. So he understands he has a very challenging task. He's got a view of American history and a preference for how America should function in the world that he believes strongly in. And I believe he believes it because of what he's written, what he's said, the kind of people that he's surrounded himself with. And so he has this ideological view, but he is smart enough to recognize that that is an ideological view that is shared by very few Americans. And so in order to be successful politically, he has to maneuver. He has to, for example, describe his policies using, as I said in the article, Orwellian language. I mean, for example, he was criticized very severely, especially during the run-up to our intervention in Libya, when he was very passive, and the Europeans were taking the lead in saying we really should get Gaddafi out of office, and the United States was just sitting back. President Obama was quite severely criticized by conservatives and liberals for failure to lead. And the way he responded was he started giving numerous speeches and press conferences and interviews in which he emphasized the importance of leadership. And he said, I'm not failing to lead. I believe in American leadership. And then when you look carefully at what he says he means by leadership, he uses terms such as the ones you just quoted from our article, where he says he believes in a leadership that recognizes the rise of countries like China and India and Brazil. It's a U.S. leadership that recognizes our limits in terms of resources and capacity. Now, I mean, what does he mean by leadership? What he's saying is it's a leadership that understands that we can't assert ourselves. It's a leadership that understands that we can't lead. It's a leadership that understands that we shouldn't act unless we are in some major international consensus, unless we have the support of the Arab League and the UN Security
exactly.
Council.
Exactly. I mean, there has been, I can't think of a president in recent memory or perhaps ever who has been so in love with the word multilateral and so averse to the word unilateral. Almost any action, however craven, is fine if, in fact, you can drag a few members of a posse with you in that direction or be dragged by the posse. And anything that is an action by ourselves, no matter how right it may be or turn out to be, that's bad. We've all got to go in lockstep, or at least partial lockstep. But what's interesting to me is this is a president who was quite willing to be, for example, engaged in Libya. Where was this leadership back when there was a serious possibility of an Iranian version of Arab Spring that might have toppled the regime of the mullahs? Where was that leadership then?
Well, part of this view of history that I think President Obama has is a rejection of the idea of the United States as leader of the free world. And it's interesting that one of the people that he appointed, Professor Anne Marie Slaughter, whom we talked about before, the Princeton professor, whom he appointed to a very important position in the State Department, has specifically written an attack on the concept of America as leader of the free world. And she basically doesn't like the concept of free world, because she basically says, you know, the democracies have so many flaws that they shouldn't be holding themselves out as kind of morally superior. And she doesn't like the idea of leadership.
But the idea, I mean, well, we have to take a break. When we come back, I will take a look at that thing which has always amazed me the most. There are no people on the planet who are more beholden to free societies and who would be crushed more quickly by despotic regimes than these very people. And yet they continue to try and pretend that there is complete moral ambivalence and ambiguity here. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show. We're talking to senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, Douglas Feith. who has written an article, Obama's Failure to Lead, that appears at National Review Online. It is most interesting to note people who fail to note any kind of moral distinction between, say, the United States and Nazi Germany, or the free world and unfree parts of the world. Again, these are either people who are terribly disingenuous or just dumb as a post. I mean, the differences are obvious. You might start by asking people who have lived under both systems. Talk to a few refugees. For all of the failures of the free world, capital F, capital W, that part of this planet at its worst is light years ahead of the other part of the planet at its best, both in terms of intent, in terms of action, in terms of rhetoric. And it just is remarkable for me to hear this kind of thing, because it is people like these very academics who would be the first to be slammed into a gulag if, in fact, that point of view prevailed here.
Yes, and it's interesting that when these people talk about the kind of nasty regimes that you're describing, and instead of seeing it as you do and saying, well, we are clearly superior in the way we live and function to those nasty regimes, what a number of these people with this, what I would describe as, you know, this progressive academic view do is they look to see how the United States is somehow responsible for the nastiness of those regimes. And, I mean, it goes back to, you know, a phrase that Gene Kirkpatrick made famous about 30 years ago in a speech she gave where she talked about the blame America first mentality. And if, you know, one of the most famous things that President Obama did at the beginning of his term of office was he gave a speech in Cairo, Egypt, in June of 2009, and he addressed there, for example, the problems that the United States has with Iran. And Iran is precisely one of those nasty regimes that you were referring to. And in the Cairo speech, he said he wanted to explain why does the United States have a problem with the Iranian regime. And he made no reference whatsoever to Khomeini and the Khomeini ideology and the fact that Iranian leaders have referred to the United States as the great Satan and that they are ideologically opposed to, you know, Western liberal democratic ideas.
Stamping out women's rights and all the rest.
Right, women's rights and is a particular problem for them. Instead of mentioning any of these ideological problems, he said, as a way of explaining why the United States has a problem with Iran, and this is a quote from his 2009 speech, President Obama said, "For many years, Iran has defined itself in part by its opposition to my country, and there is indeed a tumultuous history between us. In the middle of the Cold War, the United States played a role in the overthrow of a democratically elected Iranian government." Now, what he's saying is true. We did play a role in the overthrow of an elected Iranian government.
Over half a century ago.
In the early 1950s. But the notion that is what underlies the problems now between the United States and the extremist clerics who run Iran is a weird ahistorical notion. I mean, for so many reasons, but not least because the clerics who run Iran have no sympathy whatsoever for the very left-leaning guy that we overthrew in the early 50s. And it's clear that the problem that we have with the Iranian regime is an ideological problem, and to suggest that it goes back to that it's not ideological and that it's basically America's fault is a very interesting frame of mind. By the way, what President Obama did, I mean, he was effectively apologizing to the Iranians here that, you know, the reason we have problems in our relationship is because of what the United States did 50 or 60 years ago. And it was completely in line with the suggestion in that article by Samantha Power that the United States should adopt a mea culpa culture, because the Cairo speech was full of mea culpas, this being one of the more egregious ones.
Mm-hmm.
And it just goes to show that the president has this negative view, and he understands that it's not popular to emphasize it, and he understands that if he tried to drive his policies straight along his ideological lines, he would get enormous resistance and would probably not get reelected. And so his challenge as president is, how does he maneuver pragmatically, doing what is politically required of him and what the public generally expects him to do?
And we will come back and talk about that after these messages. Welcome back to the Jimbo Hannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO. Douglas Feith is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, online at hudson.org, and has written the article, Obama's Failure to Lead. And let's wrap up on the extent to which the president has been able to sell an amended version of what would appear to be his actual policies.
Well, I think his main challenge is, how does he square his ideology with actions and statements that he can make that will actually be accepted by the American people that basically don't share his ideology. And that's part of the reason that his national security picture looks so mixed to people. He's had to make some accommodations to political realities. But I think that if the president gets reelected and is not concerned, as he is now, about his second term, I think that we will see a much more ideological national security policy from him.
So, in other words, he will be freed from the need to worry about reelection.
Correct.
Interesting. Well, certainly things to consider, obviously, as Election Day approaches in this country. People, I wonder the extent to which the president's views are the views of other world leaders, let's say the ones that matter, Western Europe, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, generally the civilized Western world, the free world, to use an unfortunately politically incorrect term. Do they go along with this, or are they somewhat taken aback by the withdrawal of U.S. leadership?
Well, I think it varies from leader to leader. I've heard some praise from him. They tend to be from left of center officials around the world who are very pleased to see an American president adopt the kinds of policies that a lot of America's critics around the world were advocating for us throughout the last decade.
Yeah, and others probably not so much. We must wrap on that point. Stay on the line. We'll speak off air. Douglas Feith, senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. Hudson.org is their website. I'm Jimbo Hannon on the Dial Global Radio Networks.